Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded. On this week's episode, I am super excited to be introducing you to our next special guest, physiotherapist Rebecca Gawler. Working as a physiotherapist with her own lived experience of disordered eating, Beck began to notice the link between physiotherapy presentations and struggles with disordered eating, especially when working with a lot of athletes, those who overexercise, or those who have sustained injuries as a result of a rapid increase in exercise. Not only that, but Beck sees people who have struggles with body image, compulsive exercising, or people who use exercise as a way to cope with difficult emotions. On this week's episode, Beck will be able to share with us a little bit more about the work that she does in supporting people in the recovery process with disordered eating, providing education and advocacy around the awareness of eating disorders and the tailored support that can be provided by physiotherapists. So please welcome our next guest, Beck.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Beck.
Thank you for having me.
Would you be able to provide a little brief background information about yourself and maybe speak about some things that you like to do to stay well?
Of course. So I'm a physiotherapist. I'm based in Melbourne and currently working in private practice. I do a bit of a variety of things, which I really love. So I've done a bit of work in just like your usual musculoskeletal pain, back pain, neck pain, those sort of things. I also work with women who are going through pregnancy, so pre and postnatal, to help them with pain and exercise. And I do a bit of work in hypermobility and chronic illness, so working with people with chronic fatigue and long COVID and those other chronic conditions with fatigue management and that sort of thing. And I also work with chronic pain as well. But my main interest that I really am passionate about is working with people in eating disorder recovery. So I love helping people in the recovery journey, looking at movement and any injuries they have, any bone density issues, things like that. I really enjoy helping people in that journey. So I'm working across two clinics at the moment, and I really love the variety of working across a couple of clinics. I've got one that focuses a bit more on clinical Pilates and more your musculoskeletal pain. I see a bit of variety at both, and then one that's a little bit more eating disorder. And I love kind of having a mix in my week of different things.
Yeah, and you would still get a lot of crossover as well.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of those things, people come to me with four or five different things that all come into those categories. And in terms of things I do to stay well, I think as a health professional, particularly working in eating disorders, it's so important to be able to look after myself. And it's something I'm learning more and more, and I'm sure I have a long way to go still about how to do that. Speaking of movement today, I love a bit of movement. I'm recovered from an eating disorder myself, and I haven't always had the best relationship with movement, but now I find it's one of the best ways to care for myself, and I really enjoy going for a walk out in nature or doing some Pilates. I do a sport called calisthenics as well, which is a bit like dancing kind of. And that's a really fun way to hang out with friends and enjoy moving together. I also have been thinking a lot recently about having small pockets of rest, because I think it's easy to think about on the weekends, like going and doing an activity out in nature, catching up with friends. And I really enjoy those things. But having little things throughout my day in between clients, like taking a bit of a break to go and stand in the sun, or a couple of minutes of stretching, putting on a song I like and having a little dance, making myself a cup of tea, just having those little pockets of rest and self-care throughout the day, I find makes a really big difference to be able to be present for my clients.
Yes, I really love that, the little moments. I love the one of like sitting in the sun, getting some sunlight.
Yeah, I think because I work in a little room all day, it's really nice to get out and have a bit of wind and sun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's even nicer when it's like winter and then you get that sun out and you're just, oh, it just feels so good.
So good. Absolutely.
And I guess each week on the podcast, we do like to ask our guests about a recent challenge that they've experienced and how they have managed to overcome it. Do you have one?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's always a lot of different challenges in life, in work. But I think one recently has been, in terms of my work, actually working out a little bit about where I fit. Because I think as a physio in this space, it's a relatively new thing to be a physio in this space. And I've sort of started in physio clinics, but some of them aren't set up super well to be inclusive to those with eating disorders. And then being in sort of a dietitian space doesn't necessarily work because there's not the right equipment or the right space for movement. So it's been a bit of a challenge to work out how do I actually do this well and in what space do I do that? And I'm really lucky to have recently found a clinic that works really well for that. But then it was sort of working out how do I actually set that up? What equipment do I get? How do I make it a really inclusive space in terms of physio has been a really big challenge, but also really rewarding to have sort of keep working that out and being able to organize that a little bit. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I would love to hear more about it. So I guess on the topic of today, we are going to be talking about movement. So what is movement?
It's a great question. Movement, I often find, is a lot broader than people think. We often think about, and I like the term movement because I think it is a bit more broad. The term exercise often becomes really associated with going to the gym or doing group exercise classes. And that sort of really structured exercise that's for a longer period of time with a really distinct purpose. But I really like the term movement because it's so much more broad. Really, movement is any time we're moving our body. So that can be structured, it can be unstructured, it can be in short bursts, it can be long bursts, it can be intentional, like I'm going to move my body now, or it can be unintentional, like you're gardening, grocery shopping, when you go and walk the dog, transport, all of that counts towards moving our body and all adds up.
Yes, definitely. And I guess then what would be maybe an unhealthy relationship with movement within eating disorders?
Yeah, it's really, really common to have an unhealthy relationship with movement for those with eating disorders. There's some studies that say it's up to 80% of people. So it's a huge part of eating disorders for a lot of people. And it's difficult to define sometimes for people because it can be a muddle of healthy and unhealthy all happening at once. So how I like to look at it is using the term dysfunctional exercise, which captures everything from avoiding exercise completely due to anxiety or to doing way too much exercise because it's more that excessive compulsive exercise or doing what's seen as a normal amount of exercise, but with not a very healthy mindset behind it. So generally, we're looking at three different sort of branches of dysfunctional exercise. One is excessive, so just doing way too much, more than anyone would consider normal. Another is compulsive. So that's exercise that's really driven by guilt, shame, anxiety. It's a little bit of an addiction kind of pattern where if you don't exercise, you feel really bad withdrawal symptoms. There's lots of guilt and lots of uncomfortable emotions when you're not moving. And then the other is compensatory. So that's often very linked in with food intake. So people who exercise to counteract that food intake. So if they've eaten too, what they perceive as too much food or the wrong sort of food or any feeling any discomfort around what they've eaten, using exercise as kind of like a punishment or a way to earn food can be another way as well. And people don't have to have all three. You can just have one or two, but they're sort of the three main branches that I see. Yeah.
Yes. And I guess, when did you start to see the prevalence of eating disorders within physiotherapy?
Yeah, I did a project at uni on the role of physiotherapy in eating disorder recovery. So that's kind of where it all started. We got to choose our topic and I was like, wouldn't it be great if there was just a little bit more awareness amongst physios about the sort of language they could use or how to pick up if someone has an eating disorder and how to refer on. And as I started delving into the research, I found that there was actually this whole role for physios to help with the recovery process, not just to be aware. And that was really cool to have the time, as usual at uni, to delve into all the research and actually look at it all. And then once I got out of uni, I was working in a private practice and I was just getting my head around all the basic physio stuff. So I just kind of put the eating disorder stuff to the side and was like, I'll get back to that at some point, but I think it's a really important area. And I was a little bit shocked to see that there were not really many physios at all working in this area. There's a lot happening overseas in the UK and the US, but in Australia, it's a relatively new, evolving kind of field. And then after a while, I decided that I was going to kind of put together a bit of a service and advertise it. And it was really interesting once I advertised it. It was amazing how many clients that hadn't shared about their eating disorder opened up about their struggles. So I'd been seeing them for a while and they had just been keeping it to themselves. And once I sort of advertised that I do eating disorder stuff, very excitedly told me about their eating disorder and wanted to chat about how we could incorporate that and talk about that in session in terms of their movement. Which just shows how much stigma there still is around eating disorders, I think, that people are so nervous to share it with health professionals, very valid, very understandably, because of negative experiences they've had and the stigma that might be around it. But there's so many more that I was already treating than I realized. Yeah, and I think physios see a big proportion of people with eating disorders because we're often seeing athletes, and there's a higher rate of eating disorders amongst athletes. And then we're often seeing people who've had injuries, and a lot of injuries, particularly if they're sport related, are because of a sudden increase in exercise. So you're more likely to get injured if you, you know, all of a sudden decide to take up running and you want to run 10K straight away rather than gradually building up. And with dysfunctional exercise, that's really common to kind of have this all or nothing and hit it really hard. So I think physios often see more than kind of the normal population in terms of eating disorders. So it's really common.
Yeah, I think so. Especially when you, like, let's say you've got an illness or an injury or something like that, you are, you know, considering food, like what are you doing at home in all that time and recovery time? And if you've had one in the past, it can really come up, and having the support around an injury or things like that is not as common to kind of find. And it's so important and it's so needed for those people in that time that it's so nice to see that physiotherapy can encompass that, because that's the person that they're mostly going to be seeing to kind of help them, like, increase their mobility.
Absolutely. And it's often a really challenging thing for athletes if regardless of whether they have an eating disorder or not, who've put their whole identity in what they do, when they have to step back away from that because of an injury, there's so much more than the actual injury that a physio is dealing with. There's often a huge emotional and mental side of it, and a lot of fear, will I ever be able to get back? That sort of thing that we have to manage as well.
I definitely think there needs to be more mental health support around that injury stage as well, and people being specific around understanding the experiences. So it's nice to see that we'd be able to start bringing it.
Absolutely, definitely. And it's not something that's generally taught or talked about amongst physios enough, I don't think.
Yeah, so it's great to hear. So I guess, how might movement then come into recovery?
Yeah, so movement is actually a really important part of recovery. And typically in eating disorder recovery, movement has been, often people are told to not move and stop movement to recover. And then at some point when they're medically cleared, are told, go for it, you can exercise. And that's generally the approach as far as movement. But there's lots of problems with completely stopping someone from moving, because sometimes it means that their relationship with exercise isn't actually addressed. We're just kind of putting a stop to it and not actually dealing with the issues that are coming up. And then there's a higher risk of relapse when they do restart exercise, because they haven't necessarily learned how to do it in a really healthy way. And so you might get to a point where you're pretty much recovered and eating's really good, you know, you've gained weight, you're medically stable, you're feeling pretty good emotionally and mentally. And then people go and add in movement, and it's a really triggering environment and triggering activity for them, and it can cause people to relapse. So actually addressing it as we go can be really important. It is a coping mechanism, and sometimes if you remove it too quickly for people, that can lead to other unhealthy behaviors. So it's finding that balance of how much do we keep in to help but not cause harm. And there's been some studies more recently that have shown there's lots of benefits of movement in recovery. But as long as it is evidence-based and supported, and there's accountability from a health professional, it's prescribed by a health professional, and supported, it can reduce the relapse risk and improve your quality of life, better long-term outcomes. And there's been no negative effects on recovery by adding it in. but we've just got to add it in a really careful way at an appropriate level.
Yes. And I guess what are some examples of how you might bring physiotherapy into the recovery?
Yeah. So with in terms of movement, there are some guidelines that have come out which are amazing that show that they're called the Safe Exercise at Every Stage guidelines. And I use those to help people work out how much movement might be safe for them at different stages of recovery. But then we have to look at the individual and say, what's actually helpful for you? Because what's safe might not actually be what's going to work for them. So working on adding that movement in and providing that accountability, just someone to check in and touch base and provide some limits around movement or some goals around movement. I also do a lot of education with people. So there's often the eating disorder voice can be really strong and it can really have a lot of myths around exercise that it can use to help drive that dysfunctional exercise. And so we do a lot of breaking down of fitness myths. How much movement do you actually have to do to achieve certain goals? Why is rest days important? You know, are there benefits of small amounts of movement and kind of talking through that? And also helping people learn how to listen to their body, because that can be really hard when you have a dysfunctional relationship with your body. It becomes really difficult to listen to it. But physios can help in other ways apart from movement as well. There's the musculoskeletal kind of side of things. So stress fractures are really common in those who overexercise or have eating disorders. And management of those might look a bit different if someone's got an eating disorder as well, because if exercise is a big coping mechanism for them, and typically the advice of stress fractures is stop everything, we actually need to work out how can we keep this person safe by finding enough alternatives to movement, but not so much that they can't heal. And then overuse injury is really common as well. And tightness and stiffness, which can be stress related or eating disorder related, and pain. All of those are really common too. I also work with a lot of people who have bone density issues, so osteoporosis and osteopenia, and movement can be helpful or harmful for that depending on how you go about it. So helping people with using exercise to help improve their bone density. Physio can also help with manual therapy, so using hands-on to help release some tension, encourage acceptance to touch, get people used to being touched in more of a clinical safe environment. If that's a trigger for them, we can kind of work through gradual exposure to that, and improving circulation. So there's lots of different things that can physios can help with. And often it becomes quite a complicated picture because you've got someone who has mental components of the exercise, there's like a stress fracture, there's bone density issues, and someone who can see all those different components can be helpful.
It's actually really eye-opening because you see how, like, there are a lot of physical consequences that can happen from an eating disorder, and having someone aware of what's happening, especially if, you know, you've got these physical consequences and then you've got the compulsion to exercise, and having someone to work with you to go, oh, the advice is to not exercise at all with this, but I kind of need some form of movement. How can we do that? And just having someone that's open to those ideas and seeing, oh, I see, you know, you need some education around this, and the actual eating disorder umbrella that it's kind of under is so important to be aware of when those things do happen for someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find it can be really confronting for people as well, having to tune into their body and talk about movement, and having someone just aware of how confronting that might be and how slow we might need to take it. Often, for instance, I see people with pain that's related to positions that they're doing, the really protective postures, because they're self-conscious of their body. And so they're hunching forward to try and sort of hide, you know, parts of their body that they're uncomfortable about. And so trying to correct that posture and open up their chest, for instance, or get them to stand in a different way can actually be really triggering and bring a lot of body image distress. So we have to be careful about how quickly we do that, if that's something that's going to trigger body image distress and lead to relapse or increased restriction.
Yeah, there's definitely so many different components in that.
Mm.
And I guess, could you talk a little bit about maybe some themes with clients that you are seeing around ED recovery and movement?
Yeah. One that I'm seeing a lot at the moment is working with people who have neurodiversity. I think there's a lot of people, particularly adults, being late diagnosed at the moment. I've got a lot of clients who are in that stage of they've just been diagnosed with ADHD or autism, and they're trying to work out what that means for them. And that can play into their movement and their relationship with movement as well. and can be a bit confusing. What's the eating disorder? What's the neurodiversity? Because we want to obviously challenge the eating disorder and work against that a little bit more. But with the neurodiversity, we want to work with that and adapt and account for how your brain works. And so working that out can be an added challenge, because there's things like with ADHD, for instance, task initiation can be really hard. And then is it exercise avoidance or is it a task initiation issue? And that's something we actually need to push past. Is it like sensory issues around sensations such as sweating can really put people off moving? And it's not an eating disorder thing, it's more a sensory issue. So there's lots of different aspects of autism and ADHD that I find really affect people's movement, and it can take quite a bit to untangle and work out what's happening there for that person. So that's been a really interesting thing to kind of see a lot more of in the clinic more recently.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So then I guess, what have you been doing to work with these clients?
Yeah, so a lot of it is untangling those differences between neurodiversity and eating disorder. And so a lot of that is talking through the steps and talking through what's coming up for them and talking through what the barriers are, and then brainstorming ways to work around those barriers. So, for example, I find a lot of people with neurodiversity find that movement just feels really overwhelming, particularly if it's like, if their idea of movement is I have to do half an hour, 45 minutes, a whole session, that becomes a huge task. Because it might be capacity wise, that's a big task, or it might be just the steps involved. You know, I've got to get dressed, which might trigger body image distress. Then I've got to get my shoes, I've got to get my keys and my wallet and leave the house and get to the place. And then I have the anxiety of meeting people or whatever the different steps are. And so kind of working out, what are those barriers? How do we reduce them? And often that's, you know, can we incorporate 2 minutes of movement at home while the kettle's boiling or something like that, that feels really achievable. It's already in a task you've got. But then often the eating disorder brain says, well, 2 minutes of movement doesn't count. So we have to kind of go into the eating disorder side of things to debunk that a little bit. So kind of working on both of those simultaneously to come up with a way that work for that person. And that's different for everyone, what those barriers might be, what might work.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess then, what about trauma-informed physiotherapy? Could you talk a little bit about that one for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important for physios to be trauma-informed, because trauma can lead to people having a lot of triggers that trigger past experiences, trigger different things, and that can be either triggers relating to life, triggers relating to the eating disorder, or triggers relating to being in medical settings and seeing exercise professionals can be a really triggering thing for people who've had bad experiences in the past. And physiotherapy in itself has a lot of things that can be really triggering. Because you're in a medical space, you're having someone often look at your body and how you're moving. So there's a lot of bringing awareness to your body. There's sometimes physical touch. There's sometimes, you know, removing clothing or looking at parts of the body. There's sometimes certain positions like lying on your back on a plinth as someone does some assessments that can be really, feel like a really vulnerable position. And just bringing awareness to the body, talking about movement. A lot of those things can actually be really triggering for people. And being aware of those triggers is really important, and just approaching things a little bit differently. So I have quite long initial sessions to kind of understand what people's triggers are. Because often with physio, there's just not enough time. And so it's sort of like, come in, work out what your injury is, we'll give you a treatment plan, and you'll go. But if people have triggers and complex things, helping people understanding what those triggers are and seeing if we can avoid them, can we work around them? Like, can we give you, do a different assessment or a different treatment? Rather than massage, can I teach you how to self-massage with a ball so that I don't have to put my hands on you if me putting my hands on you is going to be triggering? And also being aware of the impact that trauma can actually have on people's body. A lot of chronic pain can be, there can be some associations with trauma. The body can become a bit more sensitized. With sort of anxiety and trauma can often come a lot of muscle tension. And some of that muscle tension is from maybe postures or maybe different movements or different things, but some of it can be as a result of trauma. Everything just tenses up and you can become a bit disconnected from your body as well. So just being aware of the impact of trauma on the body.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so important to go and see someone who also understands the body, so you know what movement is helpful for you with what you've kind of been experiencing and what's happening and understanding it more.
Absolutely. I think especially if, like, often people with eating disorders are very disconnected from their body because they, as a coping mechanism, it's like, I'm not going to listen to my body. I'm not going to connect with my body because that's really triggering. And so sometimes you need that external person to kind of tell you what is a limit and what's going to cause you harm and what's going to be helpful.
Yes, definitely. And I guess, why is movement so important for people?
Yeah, I think this question is really different for different people. Everyone has a different reason exercise and movement's important. I think we all kind of know of the health benefits, like you're healthier, stronger bones, muscles, heart, flexibility. There's all this physical benefits, preventing health, different health conditions. But I think the mental health component is huge for a lot of people as well, regulating your nervous system and being able to sort of feel a bit more confident and releasing those endorphins that happen when you exercise and move. But I think another thing is the ability to sort of engage in the world in ways you want. So I find I get a lot of people coming to me who are like, I just want to be able to go have a hit of tennis with someone and not really think about my body and its limitations. I want to be able to go for a hike up a hill if my friends are doing it, or go walk around the city without feeling puffed. And just the ability to actually engage in the world in ways you want. It doesn't necessarily have to be we're training for a marathon. It can just be, I want to be able to go and do this social thing.
I love that. And I guess, how can people then recognize when their relationship with exercise is unbalanced for them?
There's lots of different sort of signs and symptoms that can come up. One of the main ones is a lot of guilt and anxiety and distress if you can't exercise, or you have to change your exercise plans or your movement plans. That can be a really big one. Moving despite illness, injury, or weather. So kind of pushing through regardless of how you're feeling, regardless of what the weather's like, regardless of if you're in pain or have an injury. Exercising in secret's a really big one I see as well. People who feel like they need to hide their exercise can be a really big sign that there's something not quite right. Struggling to have rest days as well. So struggling with that idea of I can stop and I can rest and I can have a day where I don't move my body and that's okay. Sometimes it gets really rigid too. So people have a very strict routine and they can't swerve from it. And it's okay to have routines, it's okay to have habits. I think that's quite helpful. But if that becomes a thing where something comes up and you can't possibly change it, then that can be a sign that maybe something's not quite right. The other thing that's quite common with the technology we have now is really obsessive number counting. So feeling like you need to reach a certain number of steps or you need to achieve a certain time, and having that it has to be that amount or I haven't done enough and being really rigid around that can be a sign as well. So lots of other signs too, but there's a few of the main ones that I see.
Yes. And I guess, how can we then develop a healthy relationship with movement?
Yeah, I think this can be really complicated for people. There's so many factors that can play into it around previous experiences with movement, lifestyle factors, other factors like neurodiversity or chronic illness. There's or capacity or just how busy your life is. If you've got kids, if you're working, things can get really difficult to work out how to move well and feel good about movement. I think a few main things is finding movement that you actually enjoy. There's a lot of pressure in our society to do movement a certain way, and that's often not that sustainable. So finding what actually feels good for you, what you enjoy, can make a really big difference. Giving yourself full permission to not exercise as well, I think makes, if you can, it's really hard to get there, and often that's a process. But being able to give yourself full permission, it's okay if I don't exercise. It's okay if I have, you know, a week off, a month off, a day off, and not sort of judging yourself and getting yourself down with that, which is really a tricky thing to do. And I think the other thing is just learning to tune into your body and your mind around it. Often we, you know, it's easy to just put exercise in the calendar and go and do it without kind of thinking about it, but being able to actually stop before you move and be like, what does my body need today? How's my mind feeling? What's going to feel good for me? And checking in throughout exercise as well to make sure that you're listening to your body rather than just doing what you think you should do.
Yes, definitely. So I guess, how can people listen to their bodies more when it comes to movement?
Yeah, this can actually take a lot of steps to be able to listen to your body well. Firstly, you have to be able to actually tune into your body's signals. So actually be able to know, often people with eating disorders really disconnect from their body and they don't know what their body's telling them. So the first step is being able to actually tune into your body and know what signals are coming, whether it's tiredness or pain, and what's happening. The second is actually to understand what those signals mean, because that can be really confusing if you're not someone who's listened to your body before. Like, is pain the sensation of a muscle working, or is it pain I should stop because I'm getting injured? Is it tiredness because I'm exerting, or is it a signal that I'm done and I'm going to injure myself if I keep going? So knowing what that signal then means. And then this bit can be really challenging for people, thirdly, to be able to trust what your body's telling you and that it's right. Because it's really easy to distrust our bodies and be like, no, I know I'm feeling this, but it's probably fine, I'll keep going. But actually to be able to trust that your body's telling you what it needs to tell you. And then the fourth thing is to be able to respond to those signals and know how to change what you're doing. Like, is that then a signal to stop? Is that a signal to reduce my intensity? Do I just need to have a break and get back to it? How do I need to adjust it? And I find often it feels a bit overwhelming for people if they're just like, I need to listen and respond to my body, because it is those four steps. And if they're stuck at step one where they don't even know what their body's telling them, it's really tricky to get to step four if being able to respond to it. So I like to work out where people are at and kind of give them some skills to actually work at that step where they're at and then kind of progress through the different levels. But a good first step for a lot of people is just to actually schedule a time to check in with your body, set an alarm for halfway through, pick a point in your workout where you're going to stop and see what your body's telling you. And that's a really good first step for a lot of people.
Wow, yeah, I really like that one. And I guess, what is maybe mindful movement or joyful movement in eating disorder recovery?
Yeah, there's lots of good words being used for movement, mindful movement, joyful movement, intuitive movement, which I really love all those phrases. I think they're really helpful. Essentially, it comes down to exercising for enjoyment. So rather than things you should be doing, doing it for enjoyment. Exercising for health benefits. So I want to feel strong. I want to feel a bit more flexible. I want to have good mental health rather than through compulsion or as a result of that body image distress. Being flexible, so being able to change what you're doing in terms of movement and being able to listen to your body. And they're sort of the four components of this mindful, intuitive, joyful movement. And different people find different aspects of those challenging or easy.
Yeah, they're great. And I guess, how can people incorporate exercise into their life as a way that works for them?
Yeah, I think it doesn't have to be big as a first step. I think often I see a lot of people have a very all or nothing approach to movement. It's like, I do nothing at all, or I'm going to move six times a week. I'm going to do three lots of Pilates. I'm going to do three lots of walking, and it's going to be nearly every day. And as humans, we're not very good at big changes. We're not good at making big habit changes. And that can just feel really overwhelming. And then if you miss a couple of days, it's like, well, I failed. What's the point? I'll just stop doing it altogether. And so I think starting with something really small, it really doesn't have to be a lot to get your body moving and have benefits. And there are a lot of benefits of just a few minutes of movement. I think a lot of, just because of how advertising works, a lot of gyms and things aren't going to promote that 2 minutes of movement is helpful, because that's not going to be helpful for them. And if you're training for a marathon or something, you obviously need to be doing a whole lot more movement than if you're just trying to get general health benefits. But for general health benefits, there are studies that look at 2 minute bursts and 7 minute bursts of movement throughout the week and having actually long-term improvements in general health and lowered risk of things like cardiovascular disease from just really little bursts. And so I often encourage people to start really small, have some movement that you can do for a couple of minutes. And that will help reduce your muscle stiffness in the moment. It increases a bit of blood flow. It's going to release some of those good endorphins. It's going to help relax your nervous system. It's still going to have a whole lot of benefits without feeling really overwhelming. The other thing is to not make it about appearance if you can, which can be really tricky. But there's a lot of studies that show you're actually more likely to stick with movement if it's not driven by appearance. If it's driven by something, because if your appearance doesn't change or doesn't change in the way you want, then that's really demotivating and you're not going to want to engage. And if it's driven by that shame and that guilt, that's never a good long-term sustainable thing. So finding something else that will drive it for you. Like, is there a goal as far as something you want to be able to do? Is there a goal to feel a bit better in terms of mental health? Is there a goal to hang out with a friend more often so you go on a walk together? Finding something else that helps you want to move can be really helpful. And making it fun. I think sometimes we take exercise a bit too seriously. And a lot of my clients who have programs for me will have things like dance in the kitchen for a few minutes. Like that is a great form of movement. And it doesn't have to be really structured. It can be really fun. And there's a lot of great classes popping up now that are like, there are dance related classes. There's lots of fun, like boxing classes. There's ones that feel more like parties. Like there's all sorts of fun things popping up that people can have a go at that make it feel like more of a fun activity rather than something really structured.
Yes. And there's so many different sports and things that you can try to see what you actually like and the different type of people that come to those things. You know, you could do like running clubs or soccer or even like a Pilates class like you were talking about. And they've got different levels. Like there's so many things available to people to try to see what they actually really enjoy and being able to have that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think finding a different environment from something you've been in before can be really helpful as well if you've had a bad relationship with movement, because it can be really hard to walk back into if a gym's associated with lots of shame and guilt and anxiety for you. Going back into that environment, it's really hard to break that mindset in the same environment. But completely changing your environment to something different kind of gives you a bit of a fresh start, a clean slate, and your brain doesn't have all of those triggers going off as well. So finding something different can be a really helpful starting point for people.
Yeah, definitely. And even like walking, you know, like by the beach and having all these nature walks, like there's so much more that can encompass kind of your movement experience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a good one. And I guess for anyone who would like to find more information about you, where could they find you?
Yes, I work in Melbourne in a couple of clinics. I work at one in Preston and one in Collingwood. And I do face-to-face and I also do telehealth appointments because a lot of what I do is talk-based and education and talking. There's a lot we can do via telehealth. So I'm open for that as well if people don't live close. You can access me through those websites and book in online there. I also have an Instagram page and I'm very happy for people to contact me through that. Send me a message and I can have a bit of chat with you. That's a really nice way to get in contact with me as well. That feels a bit less intense than booking an appointment sometimes. I also offer at both of my clinics like a free 15-minute discovery call because I find sometimes it can be really hard to work out if a physio is a good fit with this kind of physio because it is so new. So if you do just want to have a bit of a chat and see whether it might be the right fit for you or might be helpful for you, that's something that I love doing as well.
Yes. Well, I wanted to say thank you so much, Beck, for this interview. It has been fabulous.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.